Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, April 27, 2022. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas telling members of Congress we have effectively managed the border crisis. As he gets tough questions from those members about preparations for ending the Title 42 public health order, which has allowed Border Patrol to turn back migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, the migrants seeking asylum. President Joe Biden celebrating Russia's release of a U.S. prisoner, Marine veteran Trevor Reed. It was a prisoner swap. The U.S. released a Russian citizen serving a sentence for drug trafficking. President writing, I heard in the voices of Trevor's parents how much they've worried about his health and missed his presence. And I was delighted to be able to share with them the good news about Trevor's freedom. Build Back Better, the social spending plan, may not be dead after all. We'll talk with a reporter with E&E News about Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's efforts to find a bipartisan compromise on an energy and climate change program package. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy reportedly getting a standing ovation from other House Republicans as he meets with them in private for the first time since the leaked audio surfaced, where he contradicted his earlier claims that he never considered asking former President Trump to resign after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. And high praise for the late Secretary of State Madeleine Albright at her funeral service today at Washington National Cathedral. Tributes from President Joe Biden, former President Bill Clinton, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. From ABC News, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas faced blunt questions from lawmakers on Wednesday about how the Biden administration is handling and preparing for the eventual end of pandemic-justified border restrictions that have reduced humanitarian relief options for asylum seekers at the border. On Monday, a federal judge in Louisiana indicated he would pause the rollback of Title 42, the Trump-era policy that allowed migrants seeking asylum along the southern border to be expelled under the public health emergency authority of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in order to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. The CDC rescinded the policy earlier this month. It's expected to be phased out by May 23rd. It was before the federal judge announced his intent to block the rescission. That from ABC News. Secretary Mayorkas was before the House Homeland Security Committee. Some questions from ranking Republican John Katko of New York.
Secretary Mayorkas, do you believe frontline agents and officers who consistently say that they are poised to lose operational control or some or all of America's southern border once Title 42 is lifted?
Ranking Member Katko, it is our responsibility to maintain operational control of the border. That is what our personnel are dedicated to doing. That is what the personnel of throughout the department and I, as the secretary, are dedicated to doing, and we will not lose operational control of the border.
So I just, second, please, and I wanted to preface what I was saying earlier, and I should have done it. I apologize for that. We have a limited amount of time, and I've directed all of my committee members on my side of the aisle to ask pointed questions, which generally require yes or no answers. And respectfully, if you don't answer the question directly, we will interrupt you. I just want to warn you of that. So the question is simply, so your answer is you don't believe we're going to lose operational control of the border, yes or no?
We will not lose operational control of the border. But, Congressman, you have to allow me to answer fully the question.
No, I understand what you said. You'll have your opportunity, sir. But if you don't believe we're going to lose operational control of the border, what information do you have in your possession that your frontline agents don't have, because there's not a single person on the border today that will tell you that once Title 42 is lifted, they won't lose operational control as part of the border. So what information do you have that they don't have?
The premise of your question and what you have identified as estimates of what we will encounter at the border are not estimates of what we will encounter. It is our responsibility.
That was a Homeland Security document that I had that from. So the question is, sir, is very simple. What information do you have in your possession that your frontline agents who risk their lives every day, and some of whom give their lives every day, don't have, that will tell you that you won't lose operational control to some of the border, at least when Title 42 is lifted?
We have a plan. We have a plan that we have developed and that we have been preparing to execute.
Your six-pillar plan?
And have been implementing since September of this past year.
Are you referring to your six-pillar plan?
Yes.
Oh, but has that been implemented, or is that a proposal?
That is underway in its execution. We began planning in September.
Let me ask you a question. That pillar, the six pillars. The surge started on January 20th when President Biden took office. Why didn't you implement the six pillars then? Why did you wait for 14 or 16 months to implement these things?
Many of these lines of effort have been underway since this administration began.
And the I thought you just said that they're underway and being implemented now.
And the challenge, Congressman, of migration is not a challenge that the United States faces alone. What we are experiencing is a migration challenge throughout the region, throughout the Western Hemisphere, and in fact, throughout the world. And that is why one of the pillars of the plan is to work with countries south of our border so that they manage their borders effectively.
Right, okay, thank you, I understand. But the bottom line is the six pillars came out yesterday.
That is incorrect.
It was issued April 26, 2022 memorandum. I asked that you incorporate that to the record, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, so ordered.
The bottom line is the six pillars is something you put out yesterday to cover the fact that you guys are getting, you guys have lost operational control of many parts of the board already. More is to come. And I think I'd be straight with our folks going forward.
Congressman John Katko, Republican from New York, ranking member on the House Homeland Security Committee, questioning the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. More from the article from ABC News. Mayorkas issued a memo on Tuesday outlining the objectives DHS plans to carry out regardless of when Title 42 comes to an end. The six-part plan explains a variety of steps the administration has already started taking to prepare for a potential surge in migration. It involves surging resources to the border, including medical supplies and personnel, speeding up case processing at CPB holding centers, working with NGOs to transition migrants from government custody to local communities, and stepping up efforts to crack down on human smuggling organizations. As Title 42 is a public health emergency law, the determination of such an emergency coming from the CDC, part of the Health and Human Services Department. And today, HHS Secretary Javier Becerra testified before the Health Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. It was about his department's budget request for next year. Ranking Republican on the subcommittee, Brett Guthrie of Kentucky, asked him about immigration and Title 42.
I went toward the border early in the year with Dr. Burgess, and the border was overwhelmed. My focus was for this subject of this committee was the illicit fentanyl coming across the border. And we were talking to the Border Patrol, and Dr. Burgess asked the question, and he said that what if we repealed Title 42, revoked it? And he said it would go from a crisis to a catastrophe. And so the concern is when CDC, HHS recommended, I know it's tied up in court now, but did recommend removing this May 23rd. Did you consider the flow of illicit fentanyl coming to the country and what countermeasures you know this would create another opportunity for it to come forward? What was the concern when you made that decision about fentanyl? 70% of Kentuckians who died of overdose died of illicit fentanyl. I think that's typical for most of our states. So in revoking the decision to revoke Title 42, what factors did you put into place for fentanyl or the other drugs coming across our border?
Congressman, first, I think we all recognize that we need to do everything when it comes to drug enforcement policy to make sure we interdict drugs that are trying to come into the country. But you're confusing health policy with migration and drug interdiction policy because Title 42 would impact those immigrants who are actually crossing the border mm-hmm. and not trying to clandestinely enter. They're trying to seek asylum. So when they come in, they present themselves. Therefore, if they were carrying fentanyl, we'd be able to discover.
So we asked that question, though, of the Border Patrol, and what they said was anything that doesn't discourage people from coming, the volume continues to increase. And therefore, matter of fact, we went through one of the processing centers, and they said, look at every person in here with a badge, every person in here with a uniform, and that's somebody that should be on the border. So understand Title 42. I'm not confusing it. But I do know that it is a deterrent, that if you're going to remove that deterrent, I know HHS has a different focus than Homeland Security, but surely the administration has some kind of plan in place to try to interdict this illicit fentanyl that is flowing across the border.
And again, Title 42 speaks to health conditions in the country. And what you're speaking to are either migration challenges or drug interdiction challenges. And
right,
so
but it's still a country challenge. I understand. That's
correct. But you would use migration laws or drug interdiction laws to try to deal with those challenges, not healthcare laws.
So on the illicit fentanyl, currently it's temporarily scheduled. Do you think it should be permanently scheduled, illicit fentanyl, and subject to mandatory minimums?
On fentanyl, what I can tell you is that the FDA and the different agencies within HHS will be reviewing how we treat, whether it's fentanyl or any other drug, whether we put it on any formularies.
Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra, questioned by Congressman Brett Guthrie, Republican from Kentucky, who's the ranking member of the Health Subcommittee of the Energy and Commerce Committee. Use of Title 42 on the U.S.-Mexico border since it was implemented March 2020 has led to the deportation of over 1 million immigrants. In March, there were about 210,000 attempted border crossings, and the Biden administration says it's preparing to handle up to 18,000 migrants per day in the event that Title 42 does come to an end. This is Washington Today. Russia and the U.S. carrying out a prisoner exchange. Russia releasing Trevor Reed, Marine veteran arrested in 2019 after Russian authorities said he assaulted an officer while being driven to a police station following a night of heavy drinking. He was then sentenced to 9 years in prison. The U.S. releasing Konstantin Yaroshenko, a Russian pilot serving a 20-year federal prison sentence in the U.S. for conspiracy to smuggle cocaine into the U.S. He was arrested in Liberia in 2010 and then extradited to the U.S. More on all this from today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
President put out a statement this morning on the prisoner swap for the release of Trevor Reed. He called said there were some difficult decisions that he had to make involved. Can you elaborate on what he meant? Is there a concern that this sort of arrangement incentivizes other countries to wrongfully detain Americans?
Well, first, let me say that it's a huge moment today that speaks to President Biden's commitment to bring home Americans held hostage and wrongfully detained around the world. And he's been clear since the beginning of this administration that he is committed to doing exactly that, to bringing Americans home. He's brought home Americans from Venezuela, from Afghanistan, from Haiti, from Burma, and now today from Russia. And Trevor's freedom is the result of months and months of hard, careful work across the U.S. government. Now we'll get to your question. When he referenced the tough decision in his statement this morning, he was referencing the decision to commute the sentence of Konstantin Yaroshenko. I would emphasize that this individual had already served the majority of his prison sentence for a nonviolent drug crime, and our overriding priority here was the safe return of Trevor Reed, knowing not only had he been held against his will for too long, but that his health condition required urgent treatment. He's going to be able to not only be reunited with his family, but to receive the treatment he needed from the United States. So again, our objective is to bring all Americans who are detained, who are held, who are away from their families, home from overseas. But I'm not going to be able to preview for you what processes or approaches we're going to take for those moving forward.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. President Joe Biden's statement on the release of Trevor Reed includes this: "The negotiations that allowed us to bring Trevor home required difficult decisions that I do not take lightly. His safe return is a testament to the priority my administration places on bringing home Americans held hostage and wrongfully detained abroad. We won't stop until Paul Whelan and others join Trevor in the loving arms of family and friends." Paul Whelan was also once in the U.S. Marine Corps. He's from Michigan. The Detroit News writes he's been in prison in Russia since his arrest at a Moscow hotel in December 2018 and later conviction on espionage charges that he's vehemently denied. He's now serving a 16-year sentence. On the U.S. House floor in Washington, D.C. today, a resolution calling on Russia to release him or provide evidence of his guilt. He is from the congressional district represented by Democrat Haley Stevens.
I rise today as I have every day I have served in this very chamber on behalf of my constituent, Paul Whelan, who has been wrongfully detained in Russia since the end of December 2018. Throughout Mr. Whelan's detention, the Russian government has repeatedly violated his rights, denied him proper medical care, and refused to provide any evidence to substantiate the charges against him. He was held in a pretrial detention for over 18 months in the notorious Lefortovo prison. Then Mr. Whelan's trial was held behind closed door, and his defense was prohibited from calling witnesses. Mr. Whelan now serves a 16-year sentence of hard labor, and he is in his 50s. He is currently being held in a prison camp where he has been since August 2020, facing unbelievably harsh conditions, injury, and illness. Early this morning, the news broke that fellow American Trevor Reed, a Marine and Texan who had also been wrongfully imprisoned in Russia, was freed through a prisoner swap orchestrated by President Biden. This is incredible news. It's incredible news for Mr. Reed and his family. And let us say in this chamber that Paul and his family deserve to experience the same joy and relief. Paul has been in prison longer than any other detained American in Russia. He has had years stolen from him, including precious time with his aging parents and siblings. One by one, he has lost his home in Novi, his job, his ability to communicate with friends, his beloved dog, Flora, and so much more. I want to see my constituent of Novi, Michigan, back home. This innocent man has had his life and his livelihood stolen from him by Vladimir Putin.
Congresswoman Haley Stevens, Democrat from Michigan, on the House floor as the House passed this resolution, calling on Russia to either release Paul Whelan or provide evidence of his guilt. U.S. State Department spokesman telling CNN the case about WNBA star Brittany Griner, who's been detained in Russia since mid-February, remains a top priority. She was taken into custody after vape cartridges with cannabis oil were found in her luggage at an airport in Russia. From Associated Press, Russia cutting off natural gas to NATO members Poland and Bulgaria on Wednesday and threatened to do the same to other countries, dramatically escalating the standoff with the West over the war in Ukraine. European leaders decried the move as blackmail. U.S. is supplying a steady stream of weapons to Ukraine. Latest from the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
Is there any sense after the conference in Ramstein yesterday that that the Ukrainians have enough munitions right now and artillery and everything they need to repel the Russians in the southeast, or is that still to be determined?
It's an active kinetic fight there in the Donbas every single day, including this day. And as you, I think, heard when you were in Ramstein, I mean, there are real needs that the Ukrainians have to stay active in that fight. And you heard the secretary say very clearly that we're going to be trying to meet those needs as best we can, not just from the United States, but other countries as well. That includes munitions. So what I can tell you, Phil, is that munitions continue to flow into Ukraine, that the United States is helping coordinate. That continues to flow in there, including while we were overseas just over the last couple of days. And efforts to get those munitions into Ukrainian hands will also continue going forward, as they are in a very active fight. You're asking, you know, do they have enough? I mean, I think that question is something that changes every hour, depending on their rate of consumption and what is actually going on the battlefield. So it'd be a difficult question for me to answer, you know, here thousands of miles away at the Pentagon. All I can tell you is that we know they're expending rounds every single day of all different types and calibers. And we're doing everything we can. The flow continues to make sure that they can stay in the fight.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres tweeting today, "I've arrived in Ukraine after visiting Moscow. We will continue our work to expand humanitarian support and secure the evacuation of civilians from conflict zones. The sooner this war ends, the better, for the sake of Ukraine, Russia, and the world." You're listening to Washington Today. Jazz legend Herbie Hancock performing at the funeral service of Madeleine Albright at Washington National Cathedral. Albright served as U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. 1993 to 97, and then Secretary of State 1997 to 2001 to President Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was one of the speakers today, along with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and current President Joe Biden. Joe Biden saying, "With her goodness and grace, her humanity and her intellect, she turned the tide of history."
You know, from that first transatlantic crossing on the SS America to landing in nations around the world in that big blue and white plane emblazoned with the words United States of America, Madeleine understood her story was America's story. Her story was America's story. She loved to speak about America as the indispensable nation. To her, the phrase was never a statement of arrogance. It was about gratitude for all this country made possible for her was a testament to her belief in the endless possibilities that only America could help unlock around the world, and her true understanding of what America power could achieve when it is united with and motivated by enduring American values.
President Joe Biden at Madeleine Albright's funeral. Albright, born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and immigrated to the United States in 1948 when she was 11 years old. Over 1,000 people in attendance at Washington National Cathedral today for the funeral, including both Democratic and Republican members of Congress and foreign leaders and diplomats. Former President Bill Clinton speaking about the final inspiring conversation he had with the former Secretary of State.
Our last conversation was 2 weeks before she passed away. And we always spent the first few minutes telling stories that we swore were true and joking with each other. And then I said, "Tell me how you're feeling." She said, "Look, I've got a little problem here, but I've got a perfectly good doctor. I'm doing exactly what he tells me to do. So I'm getting good care, and whatever happens will be the best outcome I can get. Let's don't waste any time on that. The only thing that really matters is what kind of world we're going to leave to our grandchildren." I will never forget that conversation as long as I live. It was so perfectly Madeleine. "Yeah, I'd like to live to be 90. 95, 100. But the thing that really matters is what's going to happen to our grandchildren's generation. Are we going to lose our freedom? Are we going to lose our democracy? Have we decided after all that all that matters are our differences in this fleeting life instead of what we have in common?" And so, Madeleine made a decision that with her last breath, she would go out with her boots on. In this case, supporting President Biden and all of America's efforts to help Ukraine. What kind of world are we going to leave to our grandchildren? That question's kind of up in the air, but not because of Madeleine Albright.
Former President Bill Clinton. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, also a former First Lady, spoke today as well at the funeral service, Washington National Cathedral, for former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Hillary Clinton describing what it was like from the vantage point of the being the First Lady, watching Madeleine Albright perform the duties of her office expertly, and also having a little fun.
"Now, it's been said that I urged my husband to nominate her as our first female Secretary of State. Unlike much that's said, this story is true. And I was thrilled when he agreed. When dictators dragged their feet or ambassadors filibustered, Madeleine never hesitated to speak up. And just in case they didn't get the message, she would put on a snail pin to signal her impatience. A dozen times a day, she would ask her team, 'What's next?' turning her boundless energy and intellect to yet another crucial global challenge. She was irrepressible, wickedly funny, very stylish, and always ready for a laugh. She brought the same energy to her friendships as she did to her diplomacy. Yes, it's true. She did teach the foreign minister of Botswana the Macarena at a UN Security Council meeting and snuck off early from an official event to do the tango in Buenos Aires. She was even invited to compete on Dancing with the Stars after she tore up the dance floor at Chelsea's wedding in the arms, I would add, of a much younger, very handsome man.
Hillary Clinton, former First Lady, former Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator at the Madeleine Albright Funeral Service at Washington National Cathedral. About those pins that she referenced, Washington Post writes, Albright's colorful pins and brooches became her signature jewelry, her messages to the world without saying a word. There were pins of peace, pins of war, and even a few pins giving a diplomatic middle finger. And the collection was the subject of Albright's 2009 book, Read My Pins, and a popular exhibition that toured the country. And in 2024, 200 of her most famous pins scheduled to go on permanent display at the still-in-development National Museum of American Diplomacy at the State Department in Washington. Also attending at the funeral today, former President Barack Obama, who awarded former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and performing additional musical tributes, trumpeter Chris Botti and singer Judy Collins. Judy Collins at today's funeral service. You can find the full service archived at our website, cspan.org. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. From CBS News, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor and the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has decided not to attend the upcoming White House Correspondents' Dinner after making a personal assessment about the risk of COVID-19. He spoke to CBS News earlier Wednesday. A response to this from the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, including what the president's plans are.
Go ahead, Jen. Thanks, Jen. Dr. Fauci said that he's not going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, citing COVID concerns. Obviously, he's the president's chief medical advisor. As far as we know, the president is still planning to attend. How should people understand Dr. Fauci's decision versus the president's decision? And is there any concern that the president would be seen as not following the science in some way?
Well, first, I would note and respect everyone's privacy, including Dr. Fauci's, as much as he's very much a public figure. But as you all know, he can speak for himself and his decisions. And every individual will make their own decisions about whether they attend this event, other events, whether they wear a mask at it or not. Obviously, the White House Correspondents Association is requiring same-day testing. That's a decision they have made. The president outlined, as you all know, a 100-page plan in March intended to position us to go back to our more normal routines. But in that requires making risk assessments and decisions about what you're going to do and what you're going to attend and be a part of, as we all do every day. Today, the president felt it was very important to be at and speak at the memorial service for a diplomatic icon, Secretary Madeleine Albright. He made the decision to do that despite the fact that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people there. He has made the decision he wants to attend in a safe way the White House Correspondents' Dinner to show his support, showcase his support for the free press, for the work of all of you, for the work of your colleagues around the world, to not only share accurate information about COVID, but also report on the war in Ukraine and all of the work that happens every single day. That does stand in stark contrast to his predecessor, who not only questioned the legitimacy of the press on a nearly daily basis, but also never attended the dinner, I don't believe. So he felt that was important and made a risk assessment to do that in consultation with his doctors and healthcare team. I would note that we also take additional precautions and steps. I would expect that he may wear a mask when he's not speaking. I'll wear a mask when I'm at the dinner in all likelihood. And we also took steps, including the fact that he's not attending for the eating portion of the dinner, and he'll be there for the program, which includes a number of speakers, the presentation of scholarships, as you know, and of course, his speaking and his roasting, where he will be on the menu, as he likes to say, when Trevor Noah is speaking. So, you know, just like anything, it's a risk assessment and a decision he made on a personal basis.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki taking reporters' questions in the White House briefing room. That White House Correspondents Association dinner is requiring guests to be fully vaccinated and present proof of a negative same-day antigen test before attending. C-SPAN's coverage of the dinner begins on C-SPAN.org and the C-SPAN Now video app on Saturday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You'll be able to watch celebrities, journalists, and other guests walk the red carpet as they arrive. Our C-SPAN TV coverage begins at 8 p.m. Eastern. We'll have sights and sounds from inside the ballroom, highlights from past dinners as we wait for the speaking program to begin shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern. And that's when C-SPAN Radio will also pick this up. Live coverage of Trevor Noah, the entertainment, and President Biden's remarks. Again, it's on C-SPAN Television, C-SPAN.org, C-SPAN Now video app, C-SPAN Radio, and many of the C-SPAN social media accounts, including YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. An article at E&E News begins, Democrats aren't giving up on a reconciliation package despite a new round of bipartisan talks led by Senator Joe Manchin that threatened to complicate a Build Back Better revival. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Chair gathered a group of lawmakers Monday for a preliminary discussion about a bipartisan climate and energy policy package. We'll talk with the reporter who wrote that story in just a moment. But first, Senator Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, answers a question Tuesday about the fate of Build Back Better. That's the name given to President Biden's multi-trillion dollar initial social spending plan proposal.
There's a lot of talk over the recess about this revival of Build Back Better.
There's not a Build Back Better revival. There's not. I mean, public policy, these major social changes should go through the process. That's what the process is for. And that's why the Senate is what it is. You have to build consensus. And it should basically go through a committee hearing, have people come in speaking for or against and have a markup, make changes to make it better, and then see where we go from then. And if you think you need reconciliation because you got a great piece of legislation, but people are playing politics with it, that's another. We never even had that yet. We haven't had hearings on any of these things.
So you might support reconciliation, but you would want to see hearings.
Reconciliation should be used for financial. And financial means we have to get our financial house in order. Yeah, runaway inflation. That should be the first and foremost thing on our mind. It's hurting every day. Everybody in America is getting hit by this. It's a tax, and no way to camouflage that. But we're not doing that at all. So we should be changing our tax code to make it fair and equitable, and everybody pay, no matter how rich you are. Everyone participates in this government.
Senator Joe Manchin on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Joining us now with more on what's been happening with Build Back Better, or pieces of it, E&E News reporter Nick Sobchak. The headline on your article refers to Manchin's bipartisan energy gambit. What is he up to?
Well, thanks for having me. Senator Manchin gathered a group of senators and one member of the House on Monday for a discussion about sort of what's possible on energy and climate change in some kind of bipartisan package. You know, obviously, he in December was the one that sort of ended Democrats' hopes of their Build Back Better Act. And, you know, there's still some continued discussion about a party line bill. But these new talks are sort of an effort to see what's possible in this political moment where you have high energy prices, you know, spurred on by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and Democrats essentially desperate to get anything done on climate change before the midterms.
What would a compromise look like? Have we gotten any indication of the details?
Not really. I think it's a little bit unclear exactly what would be on the table. There are some aspects of the Build Back Better Act that, you know, sort of everyone likes. There is, for example, a tax credit for nuclear energy. There's an expansion of a very popular tax credit for carbon capture and storage, which Republicans have been fond of in the past. Senator Cramer, who was actually from North Dakota, who was the only Republican actually at the meeting in person, said that those are two items that he would like to see on the table. But for now, it seems like everything is sort of on the table. Democrats, of course, would like to see, you know, big pieces of the $300 billion in clean energy tax credits that were in the Build Back Better Act make it into some kind of deal. And then both parties, to some extent, agree that they would like to see, you know, maybe some expansion of domestic oil and gas production, you know, exports of liquefied natural gas to Europe to help sort of solve the ongoing energy crisis around the world.
How about the White House? Are they involved in this at all?
They are not for now. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki sort of said that they are watching closely, and I think they're taking a wait-and-see approach. I think this is still very early in this effort.
And the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who would be bringing anything to the floor, has he had conversations?
So he actually met with Senator Manchin yesterday, and they discussed a different topic slightly, a potential party line bill that would fight inflation and raise taxes on the wealthy and on corporations. But it's a little unclear sort of where he might stand on a bipartisan effort and whether he will get involved actively in those talks, you know, at any time soon.
We're talking with Nick Sobchak from E&E News. There's a great line in your article from Senator Kevin Cramer, Republican, North Dakota. The question doesn't become so much about whether there's something that can attract 10 Republicans as much as there's something that can attract 10 Republicans that doesn't scare away 10 Democrats. How is this going to proceed?
Well, we will see. I think this group will meet again, potentially. If there is going to be any kind of deal, they'll meet again. And then they'll start putting something together. I think Senator Cramer said this as well, and I think there's consensus on this point that they need to do something quickly. The midterm season is coming up, and it's going to be difficult. Congress is sort of the only place where 6 months is a very, very short amount of time. So there's not much time remaining in this Congress. And the midterm season is going to be distracting. So I think if something comes together, it may come together quickly, but it's we will see.
Nick Sobchak writes for E&E News. Find his stories at eenews.net and on Twitter at Nick_Sobchak, S-O-B-C-Z-Y-K. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
On Wall Street today, the Dow up 61, NASDAQ down 1, S&P up 8. NBC News reports in a private meeting on Wednesday, top loyalist to Donald Trump tangled with House Republican leaders Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise over leaked post-January 6th audio of the two criticizing far-right lawmakers for inciting violence against other lawmakers. The article goes on, despite the explosive new audio, McCarthy remains in the good graces of most House Republicans and for now does not appear to have imperiled his bid to become the next House Speaker, assuming Republicans take control of the chamber. House Republicans leaving the closed-door meeting said McCarthy addressed the leaked tapes in his opening remarks, saying the GOP needs to move forward and lead on issues Americans care about, including border security and inflation. McCarthy then received a standing ovation, lawmakers said. That from NBC News. Outside the building where the closed meeting was held, some reaction from members stopping by the cameras. First, Andrew Clyde, Republican from Georgia.
Congressman Clyde, can you talk about what McCarthy talked about in there?
You know, what you guys really need to do is focus on the issues that America cares about, and that's things like inflation, border security, increasing crime. All of that stuff is what you guys need to focus on. If you don't do that, you're doing a disservice to the American people.
Did he address that in there?
Also speaking to reporters outside that closed meeting, Congresswoman Maria Salazar, Republican from Florida.
So don't you feel responsible whether what you guys are covering is not what the American people need to hear? Why don't we ask Madam Speaker, what did she know? Madam Speaker, what she knew, what she knew before that event. You see, now everyone left because you guys don't want to hear what I'm saying, but I'm one of you. So I know exactly what you need to do, and you're just not doing it.
Well, we asked Leader McCarthy what he said on January 6th, and they lied to us, and then there's audio.
You know, this they lied. People changed their mind. Things happened. But I'm not saying that January 6th was what happened was despicable. You cannot be storming any buildings, much less the Capitol. But then why don't we move forward? And why don't we start thinking what's happening right now? But no, the media doesn't want to do that because it's not convenient. It doesn't produce headlines.
So to talk about what you guys talked about in there, you talked about the border, you talked about inflation.
We talked about what's happening in this country. That's what we did. You know, this week, the Dems, who have the the majority, they could be presenting different types of laws to lower the price of gas, to take care of inflation. You know, the border for us, the Browns, the border is the major problem. It's giving us a horrible name. We got to fix this. But no one's talking about it because it's not convenient. You know, because the editors and the people who are running the networks just do not like that type of headline. And, you know, that's a very big disservice to this country.
Congresswoman Maria Salazar, Republican from Florida, speaking with reporters outside the building where the meeting of the House Republicans took place. She referred to I'm One of You. She's a former TV journalist. House Democratic Caucus Chair Akeem Jeffries from New York, during a news conference in the U.S. Capitol building, also asked about the leaked audio from House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. The audio tape was recorded after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. And before the leak, McCarthy denying that he had contemplated asking former President Trump to resign rather than being removed from office by Congress through the impeachment process. And then the audio showing that, in fact, he did contemplate that. Here's the question to Congressman Akeem Jeffries.
What do you make of the McCarthy tapes that we're hearing about his comments in the aftermath of January 6th and his defense of those now, that he was just playing through scenarios of, you know, what Trump should do?
I'm tempted to yield to our vice chair, Pete Aguilar. But I'll simply say, you know, the radical right playbook is simple. It's not complicated. It's in our face each and every day. It's a 5-point playbook. Number one, lie. Number two, lie. Number three, lie. Number four, lie. Number five, lie again. That's the radical right playbook. Lie about COVID. Lie about the economy. Lie about the election. Lie about Democrats. Lie about the border. Lie and lie again. And so the American people will have a clear choice to make in terms of the contrast between what Democrats are all about, delivering real results for the people, and a group of folks who lie with impunity. Facts don't matter. Hypocrisy is not a constraint to their behavior. And they think that shamelessness is a superpower.
Congressman Akeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, the House Democratic Caucus chair at a news conference today. Former President Donald Trump starting an appeal of the New York State judge's ruling, holding him in contempt and fining him $10,000 every day that he doesn't comply with the state attorney general's subpoena for documents and testimony, that investigation part of a civil investigation to allege fraud at Donald Trump's company. A ceremony at the White House today for teachers from all over the United States recognizes the best in their profession, Teachers of the Year, including the one chosen as the National Teacher of the Year by the Council of Chief State School Officers. He is Kurt Russell, history teacher from Ohio. President Biden was there, along with the Education Secretary Miguel Cardona and First Lady Jill Biden, who is a teacher herself.
Today, all of you, ring your own bell, pulling each person you teach into a harmony that never ends. Right now, someone out there is a better thinker because of you. Someone is standing a little taller because you helped her find the confidence that she needed. Someone is working a little harder because you pushed him to try. Someone is a little kinder because you showed her what that meant. And someone is braver because you helped him find his courage. Never stop ringing that bell. Never forget that student by student, the lives, now I'm getting emotional, the lives you change go on to change the world. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
First Lady Jill Biden in the White House East Room, National Teachers of the Year ceremony. The National Teacher of the Year, history teacher Kurt Russell of Ohio, also spoke, reflecting on two of his past teachers from kindergarten and eighth grade. He said that they incorporated a curriculum that spoke to him, that made him feel welcome.
As I reflect on the lessons that I learned from Ms. Toss and Mr. Thomas, I realize that teaching has to be learner-centered. Students must see themselves in the classrooms and the curriculum in order to empower and to engage. That's why I created courses that allow students to feel value, courses that deals with women's rights, gay rights, and also a survey of Black history. It's important that my students see themselves as I see them, with unlimited potential and full of gifts. As your 2022 National Teacher of the Year, I am committed to uplifting the wonderful work of educators. I am truly blessed to be a part of a profession that transforms and legitimizes student voices and plant the groundwork for a more culturally responsive education. Thank you so much.
Kurt Russell at the White House. RichlandSource.com, the news site in Ohio, says that as the 2022 National Teacher of the Year, Russell will spend a year representing educators and serving as an ambassador for students and teachers across the nation, and that he plans to advocate for classrooms to better reflect the students within them, from a curriculum that reflects their backgrounds and identities to a more diverse teaching profession. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more of Washington's top stories sent to you every day by signing up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.